Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. When we think of the times of Jesus Christ, we paint pictures of a very simple and uneducated time. Yet despite the limitations of having no electricity, computers, labs, or machine tools of any real kind, there still existed these extraordinary devices, such as the Antikythera mechanism. What is this machine and how did it come to be? Science holds some of the answers, but not all. We'll hear them in Future Proof in a few minutes' time. But first, the news headlines. Joining me in studio is Dr. Annie Curtis from the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do with pregnancy, Annie.
It is indeed, Jonathan. So this really shows how beautiful and sophisticated nature is. So the title of the study was Retrotransposons are co-opted to activate hematopoietic stem cells and erythropoiesis. So to break that down.
Wow.
To break that down, hematopoietic stem cells are these stem cells, which we spoke about before, which is like the blank tile in Scrabble. And erythropoiesis is basically making red blood cells. So we make red blood cells from these stem cells. It was a study published in the journal Science last month, and the lead author was a graduate student, which is always nice to see, Julia Fan. And it was from the laboratory of Sean Morrison in University of Texas Southwestern. I did check, he's not Irish. So basically what they wanted to try to understand was the fact that when you become pregnant, you really need to increase your blood volume, okay? Because you're trying to support not only yourself, but the fetus and the placenta. And they didn't really understand how that was happening. So what they did was they looked at these stem cells from both pregnant versus non-pregnant mice, and they found that in the pregnant mice, these stem cells were expressing a class of genes called retrotransposons. Now, this is what's really interesting is that these retrotransposons have been up till now called junk DNA. So this type of DNA makes up nearly 50% of our DNA. So to call it junk has been a misnomer for sure. But what these retrotransposons are doing is they're actually activating our immune system. So when these DNA sequences are expressed, they're sensed by immune cells through a couple of pathways called STING and cGAS. These are very well known immune pathways us immunologists would know to make interferon. And that kind of small amount, you don't want to make too much interferon. If you make too much interferon, it's going to kill the stem cells. But a small amount of interferon is really enough to activate these stem cells to become red blood cells. And that's how it was done. So it's a massive discovery. But here's the rub. I love this small last part of it. These retrotransposons are normally activated from a enzyme called reverse transcriptase. Now, reverse transcriptase is the enzyme that's used by HIV. And individuals who have HIV will actually take reverse transcriptase inhibitors. And pregnant women who are on these drugs have always suffered from anemia. And they couldn't understand why that was. And now we know the reason why is because they weren't activating this junk DNA, let's call it, and being able to activate your hematopoietic stem cells to become red blood cells.
Right. So as part of becoming pregnant, these proteins are being expressed that lead to a trickle-down effect that essentially turns stem cells into blood cells and increases the volume of blood from a normal unpregnant woman to a pregnant woman. How much is that exactly? How much blood is there in the human body?
Is there
9 pints? I was always told in school, but I have no idea whether that's true. It's one of those things I
heard. Right. That has to increase. I think about 20 or 30 fold more. When you become pregnant. Now, the only thing, Jonathan, is
wait, hang on. 20 or 30-fold more?
Or 20 or 30%.
Oh, actually, okay, that makes sense. I was like, Mike, that's a lot
bionic
of blood.
Bionic woman.
Yeah. Big baby.
Wow. So I had never really thought about you need more blood because you've now got two people, but also you're obviously of a bigger size.
That's cool. And where this applies also is when you actually lose a lot of blood. So when you lose a lot of blood, you also have to make blood really quickly. And again, this is the mechanism that's doing that.
Very cool. Shane, our second story has to do with AI and its enormous demand for power. And I read these stories and I was like, this is an insane path to be taking.
Yeah. So when we think of data centers and the sort of the infrastructure associated with AI, I think it's a bit of a misnomer to say that they're used to store pictures and videos of our cats. Really, what they are now is engines to drive AI. And AI is incredibly intensive from an energy point of view, almost to the point that a lot of people won't use it for that reason. It's akin to flying, really, at this stage, right?
It depends on what you're doing. But
Yes, but I don't use it for that reason,
right?
Primarily. Occasionally I use it, but I don't use it for that reason. I just don't find it sustainable. So at the moment, Ireland is looking at using 30% of all of its electricity for data centres in 2026. So 30% of all electricity used in a year will be used for data centres, which in turn is primarily used for AI and cryptocurrencies, right? So as you can imagine, the companies that are associated with these technologies, like Microsoft and more recently Google and Amazon, they're very concerned about this because they have wanted to become carbon neutral because it's ethically responsible to do so, but also B, it's probably good for their shareholders to show they're moving in that direction. But in recent years, their tools that are AIs have really pushed them in the wrong direction. So it's making them less and less sustainable. And they're doing the classic thing that tech does is, instead of changing practice, they invest in technologies that have not yet been proven as a sort of a way out. And so what they're doing here is they are buying future electricity from so-called advanced nuclear energy, right? So-called small modular reactors. Now, we've spoken about these on the program for as long as I've been doing this, right? It's one of those things. It's like nuclear fusion. It's, well, perhaps not quite as bad as that, but it's one of those things that's always almost there, but just not quite. So a small modular nuclear reactor works in a slightly different principle to the regular one, which is you take uranium, you bombard it, and it splits into smaller atoms and it gives off heat. That heat is used to heat water and turn it into steam, which turns a generator. And it's a pressurized water system. The new models don't use uranium in the same way. They use a kind of like a pebble approach, right? Which means it's far more controllable, far less likely to reduce in a meltdown, which is good, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it has an awful lot more waste from it, which,
you know. why can't anything work? Like, why can't everything just be, this is just objectively perfect. There's nothing wrong with this at all. There's always a catch.
Yeah, and I don't actually know why they're doing this, because like so many scientists in the paper in Nature that has discussed this just this week have said, wind and solar is faster and better. So like, why don't they just do that, right? You know, why don't they invest massively in offshore wind and solar? Mm. It's probably because of the geographical imprint associated with these things. And a small modular nuclear reactor is something that could be contained, maybe smaller space, but I can imagine from a planning point of view. Can you imagine in Ireland if we were looking at trying to offset that 30%?
Well, look, I mean, they're really struggling with wind farms, and in many cases for good reason. You know, like there's a lot of, you know, there's wind farms that need to be done, but we also need to just not put a wind farm necessarily there just because we need wind farm. You need to think about it.
Yeah. So at the moment,
there's lots of conversations happening in Ireland over that one thing alone. So you can understand if you need 20 wind farms just to serve Google, people wouldn't be down with that. But if you have some small locality, you give them lots of money and you say, look, we're going to put this nuclear plant nearby, that might be more palatable.
But we do need to talk about it, because the IMF say at the moment that data centres, that for just the AI part, is 2% of the world's electricity use, 1% of emission. And that's at the moment. Mm. And that compares with 2.5% of the global emissions for airlines. So these are two things that we could frankly do without.
You know? Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And yet, the ethical stand that you're taking, I mean, in some ways it's good, and in other ways it's impossible, because you know, all of the programs that you use, it's everywhere. It underpins our health systems and so on.
And it may actually be a way out of some of these issues. So I know there's an awful lot of climate scientists that use AI, and a lot of
in terms of modeling.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's not that it's a bad. It's just that perhaps the ways in which we use it, we could be a little bit.
They need to figure out how to make it more sustainable. There is work in that area. Actually, we might be covering in the future. Our third story has to do with grumpy animals.
It does, Jonathan.
Not just me.
No, you're quite right.
And, you know, to give it its weight, it wasn't just one paper. It was a series of papers in a journal. And the theme was basically understanding age and society using natural populations. Now, I thought it was funny because the headline in the papers were animals become less sociable as they age in a similar way to humans. That's what research shows. And they were talking about Victor Mildew. And you know what I'm going to say next?
I don't believe it.
You can't be serious.
You cannot be serious.
So basically what they did in this series of papers...
No, wait a second. It was I don't believe it.
Victor Meldrew, right?
Yeah.
I thought it was you can't be...
No, it was, no, that was John McEnroe.
Oh yeah, it was the tennis player.
Okay.
Okay, so basically it was... This series of papers was like almost kind of a helicopter ride looking at how aging influenced social behaviour of different species across basically the whole tree of life and how these age-related changes in social behaviour affects health and fitness. So like we've known for ages, and like, you know, the weight of evidence really is that, you know, sociality, being social is really good for your health. But I suppose what these studies were trying to show is that there's some circumstances where being social may actually not be so good for your health, especially as you age. Hmm. So what they showed was, and it was a gas study because like they went from wild deer to insects to birds to monkeys, obviously, and to ourselves. Now, they showed that in house sparrows, they found that in house sparrows, older sparrows had smaller social circles and were less well connected as their peers had died before them, which I thought was quite sad and also, you know, a similar situation for us. But then in terms of the kind of plus side of not being so social when you age, they showed that rhesus macaques found older animals could reduce their risks from diseases, especially if they were particularly severe for their age group, by being less connected in social networks. And then another study found in the wild adult female deer showed you were more likely to become infected with a parasitic worm as you grew older, but you could offset that by not interacting with as many deer, right? But of course, you know, then there was the kind of the final study in this series really was sort of looking at the continuum of solidarity. And I love this. So they classed sort of species as either solitary, gregarious, communal, colonial or social. But basically, you know, the big message from that was, and they looked at every type of animal, jellyfish to humans, and they found that being more social, you lived longer, you postponed maturity, which I think just because, you know, you live longer, you had longer generation time and a greater ability of achieving reproduction than less social species. But then I had a little bit of an issue because they were saying that, you know, even, you know, so you could become less social as older, but you could sort of replace that by having like virtual interactions online. And I think we all know from COVID that that just didn't cut the mustard.
God, no. Or being cared for by a robot.
Yes.
No, this is not the future we want. Spend time with the people who were older near you.
Like you.
Wait a second.
Like me, considering I didn't get the
cold studio,
right.
How dare you? All right, our final story is a really interesting one, Shane, and it has to do with this idea of monkeys typing on a keyboard producing the works of Shakespeare.
Yeah, this is the infinite monkey theorem, which says that monkeys typing for an infinite amount of time will eventually complete the entire works of Shakespeare, right? And it was one of those classic problems that was about probability and randomness. And I love this quote from 1996 that says, "We've heard that a million monkeys at a million keyboards could produce the complete works of Shakespeare. Now we know that's true, thanks to the internet." So, very timely from the mid-90s. But the mathematicians in this study from the University of Sydney, they sat down and they worked it out. And they worked it out in a more realistic way. So they realised that the universe is not infinite in its lifespan. And so they took the premise of the so-called heat death of the universe, right, which is basically it'll keep expanding and contrary to the name, it'll just cool down and go out with a whimper instead of a bang. And they worked out that if all 200,000 chimpanzees in the world were to have a keyboard and they were convinced somehow to type at a rate of one key per second till the end of the universe, that they would get nowhere near the complete works of Shakespeare.
The first verse.
Absolutely. So they found there's a 5% chance of a single chimp typing the word bananas and the chance of a chimp typing "I chimp, therefore I am" is 1 in 10 million billion billion. So, yeah, we'll see.
Okay, so not true. No. I mean, unless the universe was infinite in time, which we
yeah. And in fairness to the guys that developed this theorem, they use monkey as just some abstract notion, right? They didn't really think it was going to happen. It was just about if you let things run to an infinite amount of time, the probability for anything is one. So it's definite.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Right. That's it from our news round. Thank you, Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Annie Curtis. Now, if I were to ask you to guess in what year the first ever computer was made, I'd imagine a lot of people would be picking a year in the 1960s or the 50s. But some academics say that the Antikythera mechanism was the first ever computer, and our best estimate puts its construction at some point in the first or second century before Christ. So what is this weird device, and what have we been able to learn about it? Well, Mike Edmonds is Emeritus Professor of Astrophysics at Cardiff University and founding member of the Antikythera Mechanism Research Project. He joins me now. This is a really, really interesting device, Mike. Can you first perhaps start off by explaining what exactly it looks like and how we came to have it?
Well, it looked nowadays as a rather broken down bits of bronze. But what I want you to imagine is how it was. As you say, it comes from about 100 BC when it was found in a shipwreck. But as it's been subsequently re-examined and x-rayed and its sort of contents worked out. And what do you want to imagine? A shoebox, okay? So imagine a shoebox in front of you, something of that size, with some sort of handle on the side. And as you look at this shoebox in front of you, there is a round dial on which you can see the position of the sun in the zodiac, that's around the sky, and the position of the moon in the zodiac, and also the phase of the moon, and possibly, very likely, the position of the planets, as they were then known in Greek times, that's Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. And if you turn the thing around, on the back, you will see two big spiral dials. And at the top is one that is really a calendar that tells you about when new moons are going to occur and when full moons are going to occur. Now, that's quite useful because during the year, of course, as you know, there are not a whole number of lunar months in a year. And it's very useful if you want to have some way of telling when new moons and full moons are going to occur. On the bottom, there's another spiral, bottom of the back, there's another spiral dial, which will tell you whether in the month we're in, there's likely to be an eclipse or not, either of the moon or of the sun or of both.
What is the what is the handle for on the side?
Well, that is what allows you to move these dials to a particular date. You might like to have started off on today's date, wind it round and see what happens next month, in a year's time, in 5 years' time, wind it back and see what happens on your wife's birthday last year. So it's a sort of predictive calculator rather than a computer because you can't program it. It's already it's hardwired, as it were, but it is a very clever calculator based not on electronics, of course, at that time, but it's all based on gear wheels, bronze gear wheels and gear trains inside the device that move these dials and allow you to predict or retrodict astronomical phenomena.
Wow. So my mind is racing because, I guess in films of recent times, we've seen sort of these sort of devices and what they sort of might have looked like reimagined for various purposes. But the idea that you could figure out 5 years in the future where the sun, moon and planets were going to be 200 or 100 years before Christ is absolutely amazing to me. How on earth did they build a device like this? What do they need to know to engineer something like this?
Well, there are two things here. One is the astronomical knowledge. Now, we've got very good, although we'd love more, information and literature about Greek astronomy. In fact, there's one book called, written by a guy called Geminus, which basically has all the astronomy in it that's actually in the mechanism. And that comes from about 50 BC or so. So the astronomers at that time knew about the motion of the moon. They knew about the motion of the sun. They knew about the motion of the planets. And
how exactly? I mean, I know glass was 4,000 BC, right? So
this is all naked eye stuff.
Really?
This is all naked eye stuff. You don't really get telescopic stuff until the time of Galileo, basically, way, you know, way in the future. They had a primitive, sort of, well, not that primitive, but simple instruments for measuring angles on the sky, but nothing as far as we know that really aided the eye. Remember, skies were a lot darker then, so it was perhaps a little easier to do visual astronomy than we do nowadays. But there were many, many years of careful observations. The Greeks took over a lot of observation from the Babylonians. Babylonians were great observers of the sky, and they recorded their observations carefully, worked out sort of arithmetic sequences that would show you could use to predict things like new moons or records of eclipses and so on. And those records from maybe between 700 and 100 BC were carried over into the Greek astronomy. So they knew the astronomical cycles that are in this instrument that it's based on.
I just need to pause for a second. You're saying that just by the naked eye, they track these tiny pin dots in the sky, recognize that these ones moving a little bit faster were planets in the solar system. And they were able to do this over years without any glass or any other observations other than looking up and writing down what they saw and using. I mean, this is going to be a really stupid question, but I always promised that I would always ask a stupid question. How advanced was our mathematics at that time to be able to develop that? I mean,
not bad. There was good counting. What the Greek
good counting. Well, we'd hope
well,
to have that.
Counting is very important in how you do things. Mm. And for a lot of things, that's all you really need to do is count the days of the nights and record on which you see particular phenomena. And in fact, to see even these days, it's quite, as long as you're not completely in the middle of a city, you will easily pick out the planets in the sky, and you will notice, if you take the time to do it, you will notice them moving from night to night, certainly over a period of weeks. And you'll say, oh, that wasn't there last week. Oh, it's moved a bit over that way and so on. And, you know, amateur astronomers today can do that, but they tend to have very nice telescopes.
I mean, just even with that one simple point, and I'm actually spending too much time on this, I realize that, but they'd have to be standing in the right place and then measuring something in the sky, which you can't exactly... It must have had a device to measure the angle to the Earth or something, is it?
Yeah, probably something like a cross staff device, which is a couple of pieces of wood connected to each other so that you could move one of them up and down and sort of put one end of one bit of wood on where you see one star and where you see the other one and move it up and down until you get the right angle. So there are simple things like that, but you can do an awful lot just with your eye if you're a careful observer and watch from night to night.
But in terms of the cogs here, the engineering I'm imagining in my mind to get this all to work as a device that you can then roll the ellipses of these planets and the moon and the sun and the relationships between those, which are quite complicated. How do they turn that knowledge into something physical?
Now that is a very good question and something we really do not know. Really interesting about this device is it's unique in the sense that we know nothing else from the classical world like it that shows us that the Greeks at this time, I say probably around 100, maybe 200 BC, but probably around 100 BC, could build and design careful geared mechanisms. Now, we know from the jewelry that survives from that time that they were wonderful metal workers. There's no problem with that. You look at some of this Greek jewelry, it's absolutely beautiful. And they could do they can do the craft side of it, but we had no real idea that they could do what occurs in this device and occurs in spades is brilliant engineering design. How to design these gear trains. And what's so outstanding about this device is that the gear trains are interlaced. They have gears mounted on gears and so on to provide certain functions. So it really is a remarkable device. Of course, it couldn't have been the first one. It's too complicated. There must have been a tradition of building these devices before this very complicated one was built. And who knows how far that tradition goes back. I would guess it must go back maybe at least 100 years, maybe 200 years before this.
How did they allow for things like ellipses and that sort of thing, which isn't an easy thing? I mean, I'm trying to think how on earth I would engineer the uncircular movement of the planet.
Indeed. Now, we think of ellipses because we are used to the idea that the planetary orbits and the lunar orbit too is an ellipse. The Greeks didn't recognize that. That comes much later. It really comes with Kepler. That's when really it was realized that planetary ellipses were planets moved in ellipses. Remember, we're back in Greek times, and on the whole, it's a geocentric system. Hmm. They assumed that things moved around the Earth. The Earth was the center of the universe, and everything moves around the Earth. However, the Greeks always had a sort of idea that the circle was the perfect thing.
Yeah.
And that everything, all motions must be circular. Now, then you've got a problem, haven't you? So, but what you say is, but you can do it by a combination of circular motions. And that's really what sort of, I think, really behind the way this would have been designed and the sort of thoughts they had is that you can do it by a combination of different circular motions in order to come up with something that mimics what you see in the sky that we would more simply associate with an elliptical motion.
The Gregorian calendar wasn't even in effect yet because Pope Gregory hadn't been born. So what sort of a calendar was it working off, and what would they need to know about lunar movements? And actually the follow-on to that is why? Why would they make this?
Okay. First of all, not even the Julian calendar was in yet, because that's going to be in the days of the Roman Empire. Okay, but there were all sorts of calendars around the Mediterranean. Almost every city had its own calendar. The main one that, or a very useful one to use for astronomical purposes, was the Egyptian calendar, which was 365 days plus one extra day every leap year, and that was used. As I say, it was based on Egyptian ones, but it would be used quite frequently among astronomers. All you really need to know, as I say, you just have to watch over a long period of time and have the recordings to realize that that's the sort of periods that are going on. Now, why you might want to know full moons and, for example, new moons is a lot of civil and religious ceremonies would have been held on days of either full moon or new moon.
Right.
So it's important, you know, to keep track of that. Now, obviously, you can do that on paper or on papyrus or whatever, or on clay tablets, however you do it. But this was rather a nice way of putting it into mechanical form, so you could see what was going on. But if you ask me, well, okay, that's nice. It's an expensive calendar. Is that what it is? Well, no, not necessarily. It's not just as a calendar. As I say, it's a display device. So what could it have been? It could have been an educational device, you know, so that, you know, in a school or whatever, you're showing people about the universe. Here's a device to demonstrate it. That's a possible. I don't think it's what you'd call a calculator that an astronomer would use regularly in his work, because I did some work looking at how accurate these gear trains were and so on. And for most of the purposes, the calendrical purposes on it and prediction purposes for many things, it's perfectly adequate and very suitable for purpose. But for example, in its prediction of where exactly the moon is in the sky, it could be a day out in its prediction or so of a new moon or a full moon. So you wouldn't rely on it for that. But it demonstrates things very beautifully. And my favorite explanation of what it is it's a statement. It's a statement of what we know about the universe.
Mm.
And you can imagine some Roman or Greek official would love to have this on their mantelpiece to show off to friends and talk about and show that they were interested in such things. And yeah. Indeed, there was
It could have been the new iPhone, essentially, because it was a device of such spectacle, and presumably it would have taken a large amount of work and effort to do so, and that would have evidenced some sort of status in and of itself. Mike, what can science teach us about what this machine did and looked like and how it was put together? Will we ever be able to recreate it from what we have?
It has already been done. It's a great question. If you go on the web and look for Antikythera mechanism reconstructions, there's some wonderful reconstructions that have been rebuilt either in metal, which are clunky but work, or there's some lovely computer models, you know, which will display exactly what this thing did. And there's also a lovely old video, if you can get hold of it, of a Lego model. It doesn't look exactly like the device, but it does all the things the device did, all made out of Lego Technic. Brilliant.
What can science teach us about this device, and what are people researching about it? Because it's such a fascinating thing. And what more is there to learn from the Antikythera mechanism?
What more there is to learn, I don't know if there's an awful lot. It's really been looked at in very great detail now. What we would love to do is to find another one. This one survived because it was on a shipwreck. It was made of bronze. Bronze is fairly valuable in the ancient world and was extensively recycled. It would be lovely to find one, another one that hadn't been recycled, which had the details of the planetary mechanism in it. We know from the inscriptions on the device that it did probably had a display of the planets, but that bit of the mechanism is missing. So it'd be lovely to find a device which still had that intact. I think also what we're looking to the future would be very nice if we could find more literature sources, perhaps in palimpsest or whatever, about how they thought about these machines. Mm. They were undoubtedly well known about across the Greek world and the classical world between probably 200 BC and 500 AD. And then the knowledge seemed to peter out a bit until you get to the era of the medieval cathedral clocks.
Gosh, I mean, have a look on our Twitter. You'll see a photograph of it. It's absolutely fascinating. Mike Edmonds from the Antikythera Mechanism Research Project in Cardiff University. Thanks for your time. All right, it's time to look back at some of your comments and texts from last week's programme. And we were talking about policing using AI with Martin Mullins, how they're using AI to sort of understand what's going on in the dark web and how we might use it to explore the potential of pre-crime. Someone says, read generalized AI surveillance, rather like health screening. Discovering a disorder doesn't always mean we can do anything useful about it. I reckon we need to start from the other end, i.e. use AI to prevent criminal development, plus figure out ways to punish and make restitution to victims. Otherwise, you just get an overloaded judicial and penal system, which is self-defeating. That's from Catherine. And I suppose if you can't do anything about future crime until it happens, I mean, like, if you think this person is going to commit a crime, but they haven't committed it, you can't intervene, can you?
No.
Like, morally?
No, that's like the minority reporting, because then they haven't committed a crime. And it's also suggesting that the system itself is perfect. And we know well enough that, like, lots of these AI systems, they're programmed by human beings, they probably contain human biases. But I wonder, is our listener suggesting there that, like, the system shows a particular area that a lot of crime comes from and it's deprived, and the AI will just automatically feed, like, government funds into that area to education and recreation?
Isn't that a very optimistic way of thinking about it? But you know, if you look at, you know, developmental programs or education programs and you say, well, we have this money to spend, this is an area that, you know, that we see a lot of crime, let's put in money and see. You don't need AI, I think, particularly for that. It's still happening anyway. So, but the idea of an overloaded judicial and penal system, I mean, for sure, if you're predicting whether or not someone's going to do a crime and then you penalize them for that, that is kind of a crazy way of doing it. But maybe you could. Maybe, you know, in a futuristic science fiction world, like the Judge Dredd world, you could say, look, you were going to commit this crime, so we're going to give you a lesser sentence, and we're going to keep you out of jail, but we're fining you 500 euro for having going to commit this crime.
I don't think I like this future.
Well, you may not like this future, but what if it was really good? What if it proved that it could absolutely guarantee that it knew if someone was going to commit a crime?
Like, it could look to prove.
Well, let me just give you some data points, right? Say, for example, this is a device you wear in a watch. It's mandated; everyone's got to wear it, right? Okay, that's a bit messed up, but constant surveillance. You could say this person's hovered around the center, the shopping center, several times. Their heart rate is elevated. They have a history of robbing at a particular shopping center, and their bank account is zero, and they have a gun in their hand.
Well, I mean, they shouldn't have a gun in their hand in the first place. That's a
I'm saying is, you could probably say with pretty reasonable high accuracy that person's gun. And you say, look, give us the gun, cool off in a jail cell for 24 hours, And we won't say anything about the crime you're about to commit.
Well, holding the gun would be a crime in Ireland anyway. So, but gun aside, all of the conditions you just
gave, I know.
They could have all of those because they've just watched someone else rob from the shop and they were deadly. That, you know, screw it to them or put it to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you think about it, there could always be an explanation for one thing or another. And if you generalize, you could say, well, look, we're going to get 90% of the bad guys, but would you be willing to be one of the 10% of the good guys?
That's the problem. Yeah, like we as humans, we'll generalize and we'll categorize, but it doesn't really apply to the individual. I actually think what Mike Mullen said about they had like murderers on file in Chicago, wasn't it? And he said, when they see them all in the same area, they just throw a load of police into that area so that they'll rethink, oh, there's a lot of police around here. Maybe I shouldn't do that. That's better.
Yeah, it is. It is. If without a perfect system, right? If you don't have a perfect system, 100%, which we don't,
we won't.
Ever. And actually, wouldn't it be amazing to have a system 99% accurate? That would be amazing. But designing a system that you know has 1% defect in it, difficult thing to sell. It's like it's like automated driving, right? If we look at these AI driven cars, like the ones that Tesla are trying to bring on the road and Google and so on. We accept a certain amount of fatalities with humans because we just do, and we know humans make mistakes and so on. And that is the system. And we have cars. We would absolutely rather have cars and have a few people die, although we don't want to think about it that way. We would absolutely do that. And we wouldn't want to give up cars just for that, or transport, or whatever the system is, right? Mm-hmm. But when we get computers to do it, we're not tolerating anything close to the level of deaths that we have, because even one death is, well, a computer shouldn't do that. And so we have this system where if it's run by computers, we're expecting this really high level of accuracy that we don't expect in human systems. And actually, we should probably rethink that when it comes to both AI, you know, security and so on, that there will always be victims of an imperfect system. And a perfect system is absolutely impossible. And so therefore, an AI-driven system that is more correct for more people is inherently better than a system run by humans who make more mistakes.
Yeah, it's like, the funny thing is, it's perfectly logical, and I like to think of myself as a man of logic, but they're like, there's just something fundamentally that like is unpalatable about a computer making the decision as opposed to a person making decisions. It's like,
but how about if I reframed it and told you it was a human who made the program that made the decision? So ultimately, it was a human that made the decision, and that human was clearly flawed in the making of the program. And so, therefore, it is a human decision, and therefore, we should accept AI-based policing systems more readily than human ones if they provide a better level of provable accuracy.
Yeah, like you might in the argument.
I don't know why I'm arguing for this. I would hate this system. Yeah. I'm just trying to logically talk through it.
It's really interesting, but I guess I think we see, maybe because you're making the argument that it will be 99% accurate. And I think like that maybe we don't really believe that.
Yeah, but even if it's just 2% more accurate, even if it means we're going to be right and sentence less innocent people to jail and get more bad guys, inverted commas, I don't believe that phrase anyway, by the way. The whole policing thing, the whole prison thing makes no sense to me. But even if it was just a little bit more accurate, shouldn't we readily switch?
Yeah, but maybe our focus should be, like, not to get all like socialist stroke communist on this, but maybe when we're thinking about these AI systems, the thing I said earlier is a much better idea. Maybe be like, right, here's the government coffers, or here's the excess money we have. That goes into this area because a very strong predictor of crime, a really strong predictor is
education and opportunity.
Education and like poverty, because like simply put, like to make it maybe overly simplistic, people who have enough who have a lot of money are just a little less likely because they don't need it. They don't have the struggles. And the risk is higher for them than the gain. Yeah. It's as simple as that.
Absolutely. I had a conversation with two guys recently and I was saying, I am the product of my environment and my genes and that's it. And that's why I do what I do. And, I know Kevin Mitchell, a neuroscientist in Trinity College, often believes that there is very much free will. I'm just still not bought it.
Even though
he convinced me very, you know, he did a very good job. I was too dumb to understand it, so I'm refusing to believe it.
Yeah. But you were bound to not believe it.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I was always going to not believe it. That's it from us on this week's Future Proof. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey and Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.